Let's talk history. I'm Bob Garrett, Lansing Community College's archivist. I invite you to join me on a journey as I delve into the college's past and ponder its meaning. Here on Tales from the LCC Archives. Hello, everyone. I am here today with Captain Florine McLaughlin Taylor. And Captain Taylor is a captain with the Department of Police and Public Safety at Michigan State University. And she attended the police academy here in the 1980s, and I'm going to talk to her about that. Just really quick, I think I'd like to talk about how you contacted the archives.
So I ended up contacting the archives because I am going to be retiring shortly here. And it was suggested to me, or the question was asked, are you going to have anything that sort of shows your timeline with the police department and the academy? And I hadn't thought about that. And so I thought, that's a great idea. I remember I was on the cover of the Lansing Community College catalog. Mm-hmm. And I said, let me contact the archives. And that's how I met you.
Yeah, great. In the archives, found you in the catalog. You were part of like a photo montage on the cover, and I found the photo.
And not only that, you found the photo on the cover, but you also found the Police Academy program and a number of things that you sent me. So I was able to utilize that and turn it over to our department for the reception.
Right. And I thought that was a great sort of story. But then I wanted to have you come here and talk about your experience at LCC, because you were in the Police Academy here.
Yes, I was. I was in the Police Academy here. And boy, I have to tell you, I'm going to be honest with you. The way I came about learning about the Police Academy is I had met the former police chief of East Lansing Police Department when I was doing some temp work at CATA. I was doing salary comparison analysis for them. Sort of wanted to do something different after I graduated with my graduate degree from Michigan State University and was just taking a leave at the time. And he suggested applying for the city of East Lansing. He said that at one time they used to sponsor individuals, but it was a little bit different now. Not only do they sponsor, but you have to sign a contract. Because in the past, they had people that they would sponsor and they would gain all this knowledge and so forth. Then they would leave. And so he told me about that. His name was Steve Nairt, a wonderful guy. And the date that he gave me, the academy was actually a little bit sooner than what he told me. So it was a lot of quick preparation for the police academy.
Okay.
It seems like it was a matter of months. And with the academy, you know, you have to do push-ups. Didn't know how to do push-ups at the time, I'll be honest. You did a lot of running, not a runner. I do a lot of walking. And so I had to really prepare for that. And I'll be honest with you, knew nothing about police work, knew nothing about the academy. And the first time, and I took the test twice, the first time I didn't make it through. I missed it by a couple of seconds on the running portion of it. But I was determined that that wasn't going to defeat me. And so I went back and I took it again and I made it through to the police academy.
Okay, well, great. What was it about police work specifically that appealed to you at that point?
Well, the main thing was that I didn't see a lot of female police officers in the 80s. And I certainly didn't see any female police officers that looked like myself. And so I thought if I became a police officer, I could be a role model for individuals, for young people who had thought about the profession, but didn't know how to go about it or what it was all about. And so this was a way for me to get in and do more for the community as a service.
Okay. And you were here, clarify, like 80, well, you graduated in 1988 from the Police Academy.
I graduated from the Police Academy in 1988. Okay. And boy, I could tell you some stories. I have to tell you.
Please do.
So with the academy, it was one of those situations. You know how you had that parking lot that's right across the street here from the parking ramp? I can remember those days when we first started. They take you through like a pre-test. Mm-hmm. And so you have to run and so forth. And this is so that they can gauge you later on by the time you graduate from the academy. And so we were running, but what you didn't know is that the last person who came in from that run, they had us actually doing push-ups until that person came, until they arrived. And that particular day, it was raining, and so we were out in the park across the street from this ramp doing push-ups in the rain.
Oh.
And I have to tell you, I was sort of thinking at that time, Florine, are you sure you really want to do this?
I think I'd be asking myself the same question.
But yeah. I'm glad I stuck it out.
Well, that's great. What sort of memories do you have of attending the Academy here?
Oh, gosh. I can remember the running, of course, and the push-ups. And when I think of push-ups, I think of one of our former instructors who was an LPD, Lansing Police Department officer at the time. I believe he might have been a lieutenant. We had two, but I particularly remember this one by the name of Andy George. And Andy would have us do push-ups. And they weren't your regular push-ups that you just go down and get up. Mm-hmm. Andy would have us go down. You'd have to go around, up, down. Then you have to go the opposite way. And I swear, I am not exaggerating. Before our fitness class was over with that day, we must have done 300 push-ups.
Wow.
Seriously. So I remember that. Back then also, which they don't do now, we had the box. And so we did that not once, but twice. And I remember this one guy, this really tall guy, his name was Paul. Every time we would box, I didn't box him, but every time we would have a boxing competition, his arm or shoulder would become dislocated and they would have to, you know, put it back. And that's probably one of the reasons why now they don't have boxing in the police academy.
Okay. Did you have to box like one of the men or were you?
No,
the women
we would.
Okay.
They would pair us with someone who was similar in height and so forth as we were. And it was against men and women against women.
Okay.
But yeah, so I remember that. And of course, I'm going to go back to that running and those push-ups because we did a lot of that in the academy. The other thing I remember that I have to share with you. Mm-hmm. Is when we first walked into the room, they had a stack of books on the table in front of us. And it was like, wow, it got your attention. I'll just say that, you know, because in the academy, it's a lot different than when you're like going to college and getting your college courses. Mm-hmm. This was, you have to get so much within 16 weeks. And so we were being constantly tested. And so forth. And so you're constantly getting the information. You move from one topic to the next topic.
Okay.
So, yeah. It was intense.
Wow. So how was this a 2-year program or how much long did
this was 16 weeks.
16?
That's what I'm saying. It was 16 weeks. And we had to wear a uniform. But like I told you, I was serious about this. And so I prepared myself. I bought a number of pants in advance, a number of shirts in advance, so I didn't have to spend time washing. I wore my hair long then, and I wore it back in a ponytail, and I was focused. My main reason for being there was to make it through that police academy, and so that's what I focused on. And my family was very supportive. My husband would always bring me lunch and so forth and meet me down there, and so I'd have my lunch and then get back to work.
Okay. Well, what do you remember? I mean, you're talking about all the physical fitness classes, but what other kind of classes? Obviously, you're cramming a lot of information.
Well, of course, you have to learn about the law. So we would have to, you know, study for that. Report writing was another one because a lot of times people tend to think of police work and they think that you're going to be on the streets and you're going to be, you know, doing a lot of things in terms of every officer maybe getting into gunfights or whatever. Police work is mainly communication and writing. So you have to be able to write. And so they stressed a lot about report writing and communication, being able to de-escalate situations. So, yes.
Okay. You kind of mentioned one a little bit, but the instructors that stand out and
he's the one that sticks out in my mind. When I think about the academy, I think about Andy George. There were some others in terms of class instructors. We had a deputy Stockenauer from the county. We had Deputy Droping, whose son actually works for our department. Those are some of the ones that I remember a lot. Deputy Droping and Stockenauer and Andy George.
Okay. The academy was in downtown Lansing, the same campus at the time?
Well, the academy was downtown. At that time, you didn't have the West Campus. So, right. And Lansing Community College was a lot smaller than what it is right now. So, yes, it was downtown here. The parking ramp was right where it is, except for it wasn't this large. It's really grown. It's really nice.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the expansion of Lansing Community College is really a nice place.
Okay, I was going to say, and how was just the downtown area and the campus, and how has that changed?
They've changed the streets. There used to be a lot of one ways, now it's a lot of two ways. So I'm still getting used to that because that's changed within the last few years.
Right.
So it's changed quite a bit. It's really grown, which is, like I said, it's a pleasure to see the growth in the college.
Okay. And when you were here, was there anything you kind of did in your free time? I mean, you mentioned you were married at the time. So I was just wondering, was there like things you liked doing downtown or things you liked doing with friends?
I was very focused.
Okay. Well, you had 16 weeks and you had a lot to learn too.
When I was a non-traditional student, that's the other thing is I was older than the majority of the students in the academy. I don't believe they knew that at the time,
But
I was probably at least 10 years older than my classmates because I had worked full time. This was a career change for me. I had worked at Michigan State University. Well, I worked at the library, my very first job.
Right.
Which was interesting. I really liked it when I first came to the area. That was in 1974.
Okay.
And then I went over to Student Affairs and Services, and I held several positions over there.
Yeah, this was at MSU.
This was at Michigan State University.
Yeah.
Right. And while I was in those positions, I was always going to school to further my education. So, like I said, I was a non-traditional student. I worked full-time, and I went to school part-time.
Well, that's great. Talk a little bit about when you finished here. It did say you went to City of East Lansing first?
So, yes, I was sponsored through the Police Academy by the City of East Lansing. So they paid not only for myself, but two other female classmates. So they sponsored three women. Okay. Officers. The two that were sponsored along with me had already worked with the city in different positions. One was a parking enforcement officer. The other was a jailer. Yeah. So they were familiar with the workings of law enforcement. Me, on the other hand, I knew nothing.
Okay.
I was completely foreign. So yes, the City of East Lansing sponsored me with their department, and that was in November of 1988. And then I was recruited away and went to Michigan State University in 1990.
Okay, and you were the first African-American female police officer with both the City of East Lansing and Michigan State, correct?
That's correct. As a matter of fact, besides asking you for the catalog information, you found the article that was written about that, actually, that the Lansing State Journal had published. And so you sent that information to me as well.
Okay, I don't remember. Did I find that?
Okay. Oh, maybe you didn't.
I contacted.
You know what? I'm sorry. I'm giving you credit for something you did not do.
That's okay.
What it was is I contacted the Lansing State Journal.
Okay.
To
All
find
right.
out through their archives if they could locate that article. Because remember I told you the person wanted to know if there was any type of succession in terms of how I got into police work and progressed and so forth. So I remember they interviewed me at the City of East Lansing doing a traffic stop, and got the article, and so went from there.
Okay. What was that like, I guess, being the first African-American woman on the force, or the only one at that time?
Well, like I said, I hired on with two other female officers. They had other women officers there. Mm-hmm. In terms of being the first African-American female officer, I think the important thing is that I was an officer there with mm-hmm. the department, and that I could represent people, girls like me, African-American girls like me, who may think about or hadn't thought about becoming a police officer. So from that standpoint, that was something I was very proud of. And I have to tell you that a lot of the people that I knew from my career at Michigan State University, they were very proud as well. And they sent me cards and letters, and they would call me and tell me how proud they were of me. And so, yeah, it was a very proud moment.
Yeah, and you were saying when you first got into police officer, there weren't a lot of people in there that looked like you.
There were not a lot of individuals that looked like me, exactly.
Right, so you were able to represent and...
Yes, yeah, represent absolutely. And become a role model.
Yeah, which is great. And I don't know how familiar you are with what they teach now, but how would it be different now? And actually, I remember I saw your resume, you have done some teaching too.
Yes, so early on when I started my career, I did teach criminal justice administration course at Grand Valley State University for a semester, and then I also at their police academy, which was fun. Again, having an opportunity to teach and share the knowledge that you know with others is always a benefit.
Okay. And how is there any other way it was different being on like the other side of that?
Yes, I would say that it's different because being on the opposite side, you're learning the information, and when you're teaching, you're sharing information, you're giving insight and so forth. You're able to ask questions or answer questions that the students may have of you.
And you've done a lot of work with the community, it sounds like, too.
Oh, yes. One of the reasons why I sort of went back to Michigan State University when I was being approached is one of the selling points was community policing. East Lansing didn't have a community policing program at the time, but Michigan State University did. And I think one of the reasons why the department was interested in me is because of my experience in working in student affairs and services. And after working, I think it was about a year or two, on the MSU Police Department, they had an opening for a community policing officer, which I applied for the assignment, and I got it and was placed over in Southwest Campus, which is Holden Case Hall, one of the larger mm-hmm. residence halls. And the good thing about that is a lot of those people I knew already from my previous years of working with the university. And so I think it was beneficial that I was able to communicate with them. I understood how the system worked on campus. And so community policing in terms of working with the students and the faculty and staff, hey, it was a win-win for me and for the university.
Okay, great. Looking over your CV here, you were talking about, well, I'll just say, can you talk about some of your work in the Inclusion and Anti-Bias Unit, and then there was a Bias Incident Response Unit?
Well, the Bias Incident Response Unit is the new name, okay. was the new name for the Inclusion and Anti-Bias Unit. Yes, the department decided in 2016 that they wanted to start this unit. And the reason for that is because we had a number of students on campus who felt they weren't being heard, and the department selected me as the individual to represent the department. So when there was any type of bias or anything of that nature that occurred, it was my responsibility to reach out to those individuals to find out what the nature of the issue was and to see how we could reduce the harm that the student was feeling. But the whole point was is to make certain that the students or whoever the individual was, staff members as well, that they were heard and that they were listened to and that there was someone who cared about what they were doing. The unit also was responsible for a number of training sessions with police, with not only within our police department, but within the area, because even though it was Michigan State University Police Department, we have East Lansing, who works with students. You have Bath Township, Meridian Township. All mm-hmm. those agencies work with students. So it was a matter of offering training that all of those departments were aware of in terms of how we dealt with students. And one of the things that came out of that is a booklet that I worked with the School of Journalism on 100 Questions and Answers about Police Officers. Because many people, you know, sometimes they're a little bit intimidated by police. And right. so they have questions that they want to ask, but were afraid to ask. And so there was a journalism professor there, Joe Grimm, that I reached out to. When I became a part of this unit, and told him, hey, I'm new at this, and I see you're doing this, and proposed this 100 questions and answers about police officers. And so that's the end product.
I wish we had video so I could hold this up. But,
but that's yours to keep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That's great. What sort of questions stood out to you that you really, really liked answering?
Well, one of the things I would do quickly is whenever I would go to a presentation, to do a presentation, I would take index cards. And I can't take the credit for this. This was Joe's idea. But I would take index cards and I would pass them out. And I would ask the individuals to write down a question that they always wanted to know about police officers. Then I would gather those questions. And at the end of this project, Joe and I, we went through and we sorted out the cards. And, you know, like if it was questions about traffic, or if it was questions about tickets, or no matter what the questions was, we would sort of organize them. And that sort of became the basis or part of the booklet and so forth. And I think the one that stood out the most would be about traffic citations, you know, that type of thing.
Okay.
Because some people were told, always fight the ticket. Right?
Okay.
Some of the high school students would say, my teacher told me I should always fight the ticket. Well, I don't think it's always a good thing because officers oftentimes they give breaks on tickets. If you're speeding, you might be going 15 miles over the speed limit. An officer may write you a ticket for just 5 miles over. Well, if you fight the ticket, well, you know, the officer has already given you a break. And back then, you know, you could sort of ask the judge if they would amend the ticket to the original. If the officer's giving you a break, be thankful and move on.
Okay. Good advice. Well, to sort of wrap things up here, do you have any thoughts on your long career and your time at LCC? Anything you'd like to share with us?
Well, first, I'd like to thank you for inviting me to come down. I'd like to say my experience here at Lansing Community College was a very positive experience. And I think being in law enforcement has been one of the highlights of my career.
Well, great. Well, thank you for coming on today, and thank you for talking to me and for sharing your story.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk history. I'm Bob Garrett, Lansing Community College's archivist. I invite you to join me on a journey as I delve into the college's past and ponder its meaning. Here on Tales from the LCC Archives.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect. Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
If you're considering returning to school, exploring career options, or needing support in life transitions, Lansing Community College has the Adult Resource Center available to qualified students. The Adult Resource Center staff provides one-on-one appointments, registration assistance, referrals to community and campus resources, tuition and childcare grants, academic advising, and other helpful tools to help with your educational career. To find out more information, visit lcc.edu and search Adult Resource Center.
Fully renovated.
Hey there, this is Dedalian, and I want to invite you to join me for a show called Behind the Connection. It dives into what's happening behind the scenes here at LCC Connect. It also provides you early introductions to new podcasts, some of the Connect initiatives that we are putting forth, and, of course, insights into the concept of building the voices, vibes, and vision of LCC Connect. Find out more about it at our website. It's lccconnect.org.
Unexpected reactions to smart financial decisions brought to you by feedthepig.org.
Well, I finally did it. My student loan is totally paid off.
I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either. I paid more than the minimum each month, and soon enough, it was gone.
So you're just giving up?
Giving up on what?
The life of luxury. Egyptian cotton, caviar Thursdays, designer everything.
What are you talking about?
Our plan. What happened to winning the lottery and mastering the art of the perfect mimosa? Hosting galas? Wearing enough jewelry to require a bodyguard? Vacationing in the French Riviera and then buying it?
I just thought maybe it was time to prepare for my future. You know, set some financial goals, make some smart investments, open a 401k.
Financial goals? Investments? A 401k? You are horrifying right now. Listen, if winning the lottery were easy, everyone would do it.
When it comes to financial stability, don't get left behind. Get tools and tips for saving at feedthepig.org. This message brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
New and experienced motorcycle riders. LCC's Adult Enrichment Program offers motorcycle safety classes weekly throughout the summer for riders of all skill levels. Classes fill quickly. Find more details at lcc.edu/keeplearning.
LCC. Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Mike Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
And today we are going to talk about cannabis, all things cannabis.
Cannabis.
Couldn't cannabis, but yes.
Sometimes we call it CUD, cannabis use disorder. Everybody that smokes cannabis has cannabis use disorder, but
no,
it
not
is
at all.
A thing.
Not at all. It is a thing, and it's interesting because the perspectives on cannabis has changed a lot over the years.
Ain't that the truth?
Way back, you know, when I was a kid, and you always make a remark about how old I am, but when I was a kid, Reefer Madness was something we would watch in midnight movies, and it was funny as hell, because it's like, oh, don't, you know, it'll make you crazy, it'll make you oversexed, it will make you crazy, you'll get addicted to it, all that kind of stuff, and people would laugh at it, because obviously those were all myths.
It's really a cult classic, Reefer Madness.
It's a cult classic, you know. But it turns out some of those things are true some of the time with some of the people.
It's true. So
there's been a lot of...
But probably a lot less so than it was once thought to be.
A lot less, and it was something that...
In terms of making somebody psychotic.
Caucasian audiences did not experience cannabis as much as the black culture did for years and years.
You mean like the prevalence of smoking?
The prevalence, yeah. A lot of jazz musicians would smoke a lot of pot back in the, way back, you know, in the 20s and 30s. Louis Armstrong used to call it, what did he call it? He had a nickname for it. Muggles, I think is, he called them Muggles. Muggles. He did songs that had Muggles in the title.
I didn't know.
And then gradually, in the I think the hip guys, not the beboppers, those are jazz guys. I'm thinking about the poets, the beat poets started.
That's what I was thinking, the beatniks.
Yeah.
The beatniks. Like Jack Kerouac
and then, you know, the hippies.
William S. Burroughs.
And then how old were you when you were first exposed to it, to marijuana?
Gosh. I would have to think. The first time I came aware of it, probably in my early adolescent, you know, 11, 12, 13. I grew up in a small town. We were fairly sheltered. My parents did not smoke marijuana. I didn't know anybody that smoked cannabis, or at least I didn't know that I know anybody that smoked cannabis. If you did at that time, at least in my circle or my family circle, it wasn't something you would advertise, especially around children.
Yeah, well, that was younger than when I first encountered it was in high school. So that was a few years after you did. I was aware of it, and I was aware that there were some people that were smoking it. But I think it was either junior or senior year was the first time I was ever in a room with someone that was smoking it. And I was scared of it, you know, because of what I'd heard. And they were passing it around. Do you want this? No, thanks. But the first time I used it, I think... I don't want to indicate who it was with, but I didn't feel anything from it. I didn't get any kind of buzz at all from it.
Yeah.
And then the year between, I think between senior year and then college, I smoked with some buddies and we smoked a couple of joints and I really felt that and I really enjoyed it. really was something very, very different than I experienced before, and different than what I thought it was going to be too.
Yeah, my first exposure was in high school as well. And now that I'm thinking about it, the first time I was around it and offered it was there was a Smashing Pumpkins concert. So I was 16. It was Smashing Pumpkins at the Breslin Center here. And a bunch of us, I think I was a sophomore at the time, we bought tickets. And so there was like 6 or 8 of us from my high school that went. Somebody had some marijuana. So it was a bag. It was in a Ziploc bag. It was, you know, I mean, I'm not around marijuana, but I work with it in terms of like working with people that smoke marijuana. So it's just so much more available. You can, you know, the dispensaries, it's, you know, it's legal in Michigan.
That's exactly right.
So this way it was like, so who's got it? How do you get it? You know, where do you get it from? It's clandestine. It's secretive. It was very, you know, it was very taboo.
Very illegal.
And, it was.
And classified. I mean, John Sinclair, I remember being, was I in college when John Sinclair got arrested? And he was sentenced to years in prison for having 3 joints, I think, or 2 joints, something like that. So it was legally, they thought about it as heroin, which just seemed ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, it does now, for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, the evolution that I have, and it's interesting because I have the book, I wrote a book about this, and it's called The Little Green Book by Michael Stratton. And the reason I wrote this book was because as a therapist, I became a trainer, a federal trainer in how to intervene with teenage drug users, substance users, specifically cannabis users, and was sent around the country to train therapists on how to intervene with that. And we'll talk about the intervention stuff in the second part of this show. But the first part of it, in terms of, you know, my relationship with cannabis to begin with, was that it started very gradually and it grew, and I became, I'd have to say I became dependent on it. It was something I started to use every day and used at inappropriate times of the day, you know, the wake and bake, being pretty crisp all the time. And when I finally stopped doing that, which was years and years into that relationship, I had to rethink about, you know, what that whole relationship was like and what I was doing and how it was helping me and also what I was avoiding, you know?
I like the use of the term relationship. And that's when I'm talking with clients, you know, that's kind of the context. What is your relationship with a substance, you know, and marijuana is a very prevalently used substance. Is it a daily thing? Is it happening all the time? Is it recreational? Is it something you feel like you need? Is it something that you feel like makes you a better person, a smarter person? Does it help you sleep? You know, there's all sorts of ways
for
in which people utilize it or you know, and their concept of it. So that's a good way to think about it.
I like it because one of the big things that people have internally is this idea that they can't possibly get addicted to it or be dependent on it. And often if you talk about it that way, they'll want to argue and they'll want to show the evidence of that. But if you just talk in terms of your relationship to it, they're more open to talking about that.
Yeah. Triggering resistance is something we try to avoid. Just being able to feel in an interview or, you know, when we're talking about marijuana, because it's a standard assessment piece when you're meeting with somebody to, you know, talk about the relationship with substances, going back to that idea of relationship, tobacco, alcohol, marijuana. And then I talk about illicit drugs outside of cannabis, which we used to talk about cannabis as an illicit drug, but I don't really talk about it that way.
One thing I want to be clear about, because sometimes people think, oh, you're anti-marijuana because I wrote this book. I'm not anti-marijuana. I've always been a proponent of it being legalized and regulated and taxed. That just always made a lot of sense to me. And I think it's the treatment of choice for certain conditions, seizure disorders, for instance. Not that long ago, I was meeting with somebody who was describing that they were having seizures after they stopped using it. And as we talked more about it, they talked about having some light seizures prior to when they began using it. And it's like, oh, maybe it's not that you're having seizures that you stopped it, but maybe using it was keeping you from having seizures.
There is an anti-seizure approach that uses cannabinoid. It's a synthetic cannabinoid.
The CBD.
This is actually a pharmaceutical. So CBD is not a prescription, you know, a pharmaceutical FDA regulated prescription. There is one synthetic cannabinoid, and I'm blanking on the name, but is used in very, it's indicated for very isolated reasons. One is seizures. It's not the first line treatment that is used for seizures, but if other seizure medications don't work, neurology may consider it.
Sanjay Gupta did this special for CNN. It's a documentary, and it was a baby that was having seizures, and the baby was treated with CBD, and it stopped doing the seizures. And I think that was back in the Obama administration, but I think that had a lot to do with people softening their views on cannabis and the idea of like, okay, maybe this isn't so bad. Maybe we shouldn't be thinking about it like one of the class A drugs. Mm-hmm. Class A, is that right? Class 1 drugs?
Class 1.
Yeah. Okay. So.
And federally, it is considered a class 1 drug still.
Yeah. Yeah. There have been, interestingly, difficulties that have come up now that it is legal. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I mean, it's so much more potent now than it used to be.
That's what I understand.
Is that your experience?
Well, there's been a lot more like cultivation of the different strains and hybridization and testing and, you know, all sorts of ways to try to increase the amount of THC content or CBD content. So yes, there's a lot more manipulation, by that I mean like, you know, in any type of botany situation, you will create strains of things that have desired characteristics. So for flowers, it would be beauty or color or taste, where it comes to vegetables. So the same thing happens with cannabis. So the development of strains that are just, they are more potent in terms of their content of the THC.
See, sometimes I feel like I'm at a disadvantage because I haven't used any THC in 34 years.
It's been a long time for me.
Yeah, a long time.
But my patients talk about it.
mine too.
And it's interesting. It's really interesting. And, you know, another whole thing is the quote-unquote cannabis industry. I mean, a lot of people in this area work in the cannabis industry. I know people who work in the farming aspect of it, the growing, the picking, the harvesting, the packaging. But there's also the quality, you know, improvement, quality assurance. So people with laboratory backgrounds, more of a, you know, chemical engineering background, working in, you know, the more laboratory capacity to try to create the strains that the customers want.
The people that I've seen who've presented in treatment for getting off of cannabis, originally when I would see people in college, people in high school.
Youngins.
that their parents often would tell them to go to therapy and they would say, we think they're depressed. But when I would investigate, you know, and just ask, do you use cannabis, how much of that? So often there was this overlap where they were heavy cannabis users. And they were just, you know, they're staying in their dorm room. They were just hanging out. They were playing video games. They weren't going out. They weren't socializing very much, just playing video games, getting online, and using a lot of cannabis. And they didn't see a link between their mood and also their social anxiety and their cannabis use. And so that was always something to explore with them. And it's an interesting thing because sometimes this is an oversimplification, but alcohol, like, sometimes reduces your social anxiety. Mm-hmm. That's what it did for me. Whereas cannabis kind of increased it. Like, what are these people thinking about me? What are they? Why is that person over there in the corner? Why do they think what's that?
Like a paranoia. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's one of the ways that people would present. But the other thing is that people started to present with a sense of like, I feel like I'm using too much. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm spinning my wheels. I feel like I'm not getting any traction in life. And investigating that and seeing if there's something with their cannabis use. You know, I was a straight A student up until this point in time. When did you start using cannabis? It was this point in time. You know, they seem to coincide.
Yeah, begin to make the connections.
Yeah, yeah. That it
if it is a
them.
Connection.
Yeah.
And I usually talk about a very, you know, this in similar context to alcohol. You know, it can be just recreational. You know, you're with friends and it's the weekend and you're, you know, playing a game or, you know, what have you, and it's once in a while or once a week. You know, that's a very different pattern of use than every day, four times a day.
And there are people who use it very, very heavily who are also very successful, and it's not a problem for them at all. I mean, it's not a problem if it's not a problem.
Yeah.
It's only a problem if it's a problem.
And it's only, you know, when the person begins to see the thing that you were talking about, if they're connecting their usage to, you know, a lower quality of life, they're not reaching their goals, they feel like maybe there's something, there's a connection with their usage of cannabis. That's significant, and it provides an opportunity or an avenue to explore that. And that way you can, you know, work within, there may still be resistance, but you can work within that because there's some opening there. Whereas it's very difficult to work with somebody who just is like, nope, it's not a problem for me, and I don't really, you know, I just don't think it's a problem. I don't want to discuss it.
I run into that sometimes where there's a partner of the person. It's a problem for the partner, but not for them themselves. And so that has its own dilemma to it. But the
that's another avenue of assessment too. Does somebody else think it's a problem?
Yeah.
Have your parents thought it was a problem? Has a partner thought it's a problem? And what do you? How do you respond to that?
Well, this is another plug for the book.
is that part of the book then? Because I think that's definitely a question that people would be inclined to ask as you guys are having this conversation.
Within the first five pages. It's on page 3, you know, assessing your relationship with marijuana. And I've got 20 points. 20 different points where people can go. Yes, no, sometimes, you know, that kind of thing. And it boils down to 5 different categories. So when you look at the DSM, for instance, it goes 3 categories. Mm-hmm. It's either mild, moderate, or severe. With this, what's your relationship with marijuana? If you score 0 to 5 points, you're basically a stranger to it. If it's 6 to 9 points, you're a casual acquaintance. 10 to 12 points, you're a distant friend. 13 to 16, it's in your inside circle. 17 to 20, it's your best friend. And over 21, it's your lover. It's who you want to go to bed with. And I'm handing this over to someone who needs to know. Score yourself. We'll talk in the second half with you.
I was just curious to see what you had here.
But that's available on the podcast as well. If you want to listen to the podcast that I did, the Little Green Podcast.
Right, a different podcast.
Yeah, it's a different podcast than this podcast.
But it is in the show notes each and every time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So people can look that up. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so there's a number of reasons why it might be difficult for somebody. The other thing, you've got your finger on how to pronounce this word, the cannabinoid
hyperemesis.
Hyperemesis. Mm-hmm. When people are having stomach cramps or they're vomiting, and they're also really heavy marijuana users.
Yeah, yeah. There's a syndrome that is associated with, and it doesn't happen to everybody, but if somebody does have heavy usage daily and then develops a pretty acute throwing up, they're nauseous, they're throwing up, they can't stop throwing up. It tends to be in episodes, so maybe not every single time, but some people are just more sensitive to it. So that is cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. So hyper means too much, and emesis means throwing up.
There was a show that was on. It was a cooking show where you had to, it's kind of like Chopped or something on the Food Network, but it wasn't on the Food Network. And it was people that had to use cannabis inside of their recipes.
Oh, yeah.
And then the judges were like smoking blunts like crazy. And I always thought, oh, God, how can they handle this much marijuana? It was just an amazing
Well, it amount. Also speaks to just the enormous cultural change that has happened with, you know, our societal relationship with with marijuana. As we've established, I'm younger than you are, but even in my day in the 90s, like I'm
never going to get away from it.
I would say with the, you know, it was just a major taboo. It just was thought to be, you know, really just not the right thing. And even though I think we've all sort of thought in our culture that there's always been, you know, a significant amount of people that use cannabis, it's not like, well, I don't know that actually. I haven't looked at the epidemiological stuff. If people now use cannabis with all of the legalizations and things, if the percentage of people who use it is significantly greater than it had been historically. Do you know that, Mike?
Statistically, what I saw last time I looked at it, there are more people that are using it, and about 11% of the population that uses it develops into that category of that it would be called diagnosable.
Like a use disorder.
Yeah, yeah, right. So so the majority of people, once again, the majority of people who use don't have an issue with it. Mm-hmm. They can use it occasionally. They don't get in trouble with it. It doesn't interfere with their life. But 11% do develop some kind of an issue, one way or the other.
And what does it look like if somebody has an issue? What does typical presentation look like?
Sometimes they know it. Sometimes they don't know it. So it can mask with other symptoms, including depression and anxiety, lower life satisfaction, social anxiety, just a sense that they just can't get somewhere in life, and the sense that they need to use it on a regular basis, and that if they don't use it, they become very anxious. It's really difficult for them to stop their use. Or it is a problem for people in their life around them because they see things that the person is in some way denying in some word. And I don't even like using the word denial because what it is, it's basically you're minimizing or you're rationalizing or you're justifying.
You're
Those are all ways that you just protect the relationship with the substance. So once you've protected the relationship, because the substance is something you like and something that you want to protect. And when I was using it and using it helfully, when I was using it helpfully, that was a Freudian slip. It was helping. It really did feel like it was helping me. But I could slip out at work and smoke when I was working at the psych hospital, for God's sakes, and come back in and feel like this helps me. I'm a better psych tech when I'm high. it just seemed I could relate better with psychotic people.
I think relationships too, you know, when you, your relationships change, maybe, you know, somebody who's critical, maybe you're spending less time with them or, you know, anybody who you have a sense that is, you know, coming down on you for your usage, either cutting out ties with them or, you know, moving into a peer group that's more, you know, in line with what you're doing, that can be an indication too. If you're really developing relationships, making decisions based around your usage.
Yeah. And definitely that. And I know people who've done that, who said, I wanted to be a truck driver, but when I realized I was going to have to pass these tests, I was not interested anymore. You know, for instance, that's one thing. And the other thing that I want to mention in this portion of the show is also the dosage, basically. And one, you know, that people are using these really high amounts and also dabbing. You know about dabs.
I do.
Do you want to talk about dabs?
Well, I just know about it from my experience with my clients. It's a distilled oil. So the there's a way to take the THC from the plant, separate it, separate it from, you know, the leaf, but then even distill it farther into very potent THC. And then there's a specific way of using it that's different, as far as I understand. I've
met with some people that
you have
were
to
dabbing.
Heat it up. It's through like a vape situation,
like a blowtorch or something. Yeah. You know, yeah. I've seen videos of it. I haven't seen anyone do it in person.
People were talking about it, and I really had to look it up, you know, to really kind of understand. Because I have a lot of patients that use, and so I want to understand what they're doing, and dabbing is an extremely concentrated form, and it just means there's more going into the system.
And one of the issues of independence is when your tolerance goes up, tolerance for the substance goes up,
and
so you need higher and higher and higher doses to get the same effect.
And we've talked about opiates and alcohol on this podcast, but the use disorders of and any in psychiatry, when somebody develops a tolerance, that is one of the indications of a use disorder, that you're needing more and more of the substance to achieve the same effect. And then also with the withdrawal, which you had mentioned, you know, if you don't have the substance, then you feel the absence of it. So with cannabis, a lot of times it's anxiety or, you know, inability to sleep.
The sleep thing is big, because it's so hard to sleep after you stop using it. It's really hard. It's a challenge. Anyway.
So the dab, what I wanted to highlight is we don't have a lot of conclusive great studies on the benefits or the real, you know, negative things about marijuana because it just wasn't funded. The studies weren't funded for a long time by the National Institute of Health because they didn't, well, I don't want to speak for them, but it was just not, it was not considered a priority for their research body.
They're doing a lot better studies now than they used to. Yes. And it's in chapter 3 of my book as a review of the studies. So there is some hard science behind all of that. Yeah, so that's something. So,
but what we do know, one of the things that we know is, you know, the brain is developing up until the mid-20s. And so you're still developing connections in your brain, synapses, lots of neurodevelopment is still occurring. So marijuana can impact that. Cannabis can impact that. We don't know to what extent. We don't know how dangerously, but it can have an impact. So a general recommendation is no smoke, you know, not to smoke or at least not to smoke excessively.
When you're young.
When you're young.
Yeah.
But the flip side is that a lot of people are exposed to it, you know, mm-hmm. in high school or, you know, through their young adulthood. And that tends to be a time where people are apt to make more risky decisions. And so there can be a kind of dynamic there.
For sure.
And then also we know that people with certain mood disorders, bipolar disorder in particular, and psychotic disorders may, the psychosis or a mood episode can be triggered earlier by heavy use of cannabis. And so persons who are susceptible, like they have a family history of schizophrenia or a family history of bipolar, then they probably would benefit from not using marijuana.
Well, there's the irony. There's the irony is that it's like reefer madness for some people. It can
We were talking about it. That is where, and I worked in the inpatient setting, and I have seen people who have psychosis has been triggered by the usage of marijuana.
Me too. We're going to talk about the treatment of this in our next episode. A Psychodelicious Conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health, or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan, welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is apsychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited. Keep connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Lansing Community College's downtown and west campus offer newly renovated conference and event spaces that can accommodate over 500 attendees. Professional event planners are available to guide you through your experience from setup to catering. For more information about LCC's conference and event spaces, visit lcc.edu and search conference.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alexander, and I host a show called Who's That Star on LCC Connect. This show is all about an inside look at the LCC community where you get a chance to meet our faculty and staff, plus learn about their passion projects at work and at home. You can catch Who's That Star here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
Hey, there he is. How's it going?
I'm having a stroke.
Are you going to shake my hand or what?
I'm having a stroke.
Wow, you're not even moving your arm.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you okay?
I'm having a stroke.
Your face looks weird, too.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you having a seizure or something?
I'm having a stroke.
When someone is having a stroke, they may not be able to say it with words, but their body language will tell you loud and clear.
I'm having a stroke.
You just need to know the sudden signs. Look for FAST, F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. Or S, speech difficulty. Then T, time. Time to call 911 immediately. Because the sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in their recovery. Know the sudden signs. Face, arm, speech, time. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Lansing Community College welcomes transfer students. Transfer students may apply transfer credits towards their LCC degree, certificate, or transfer program. Learn more at lcc.edu/youbelong.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
You're listening to Art Happens Here, the podcast that explores the often curious and occasionally amazing art installations on, in, and around the campuses of Lansing Community College. I'm your host, Bruce Mackley. Like many professions, graphic design is comprised of numerous subdisciplines, like color theory, composition, typography, and various other visually expressive and interpretive skills. Some of the underlying principles within those can include balance, emphasis, proportion, and so on. Within this realm, I can't think of anything more outwardly simple, yet inwardly complex, as typography. The written word is one of the oldest and most fundamental forms of visual communication that exists. In today's world, this form balances that communication with style and purposeful design. It's kind of an art unto itself. There's an old joke about television as a medium because it's neither rare nor well done. And as long as I can remember, I've been impressed at how something so clearly defined by audio and moving visuals still relies so heavily on typography. We'd been kicking around an idea for another outdoor installation, some creative wayfinding display or sculpture that used words or phrases. What we ultimately arrived at was a 12-foot-tall, kiosk, a four-sided monolithic object with words and phrases cut out. Dozens of aspirational words in various languages wrapping around all four sides and fitting together kind of like a puzzle. There'd be some typographic art elements and general wayfinding woven in, and some of the words would redefine themselves around the corners, like learn into earn and community into unity, and that type of thing. You know, viewed from any angle, it would appear or come across like some type of modern-day relic, you know, hieroglyphics at a distance, something like that. This particular project took nearly 2 years to realize, and not because of any slow approval processes or lack of materials. I'm going to take a slight detour towards something which has little to do with the outcome of this particular project, but I think the message it contains is worth it. So it's halfway through the design work on the typography end of things, you know, the balance and the nuancing and the languaging and so on. I think I'd been at it for like a week or two. And one Monday morning, it was actually Monday, October 13th, 2016, came into work in the morning, first one there, marched up the stairs. Marketing's located on the second floor in our building. Two big flights of stairs, went up the stairs, opened the door. And the door to the department is beautiful. It's this large glass slab, you know, with a lock situated at the bottom. You know, it throws the deadbolt into the floor. So, you know, you stoop down, crouch down, wiggle your key in, get it unlocked, and in you go. So I did that, you know, crouched down, turned the lock, and stood up. And that's the last thing I remember. The next thing I remember was being hustled into an ambulance. Looking up, it was almost cinematic, you know, the ring of concerned faces, you know, and I'm in this stretcher carriage thing, and not feeling at the top of my game with, you know, blood all over the back of my head and world, you know, everything was spinning and whatnot. It turned out I passed out. I just blacked right out and went backward and hit the back of my head on the cement floor in the department. It's carpeted, but it is thin carpet. So I wound up at the hospital. I stayed there for a few days, I think 2.5 days or whatever, and not a fun ride. Plenty of vertigo and migraines and all this. You know, obviously it was a concussion of some kind. Got out, still clueless as to what triggered this, and was compromised with regard to, you know, first my cognitive abilities and my perceptive abilities. It was very, very humbling. I had to take like 6 months off work at least, you know, and even after that I went back, you know, I worked from home part-time. And I'm only drawing attention to this because the kiosk project represented professionally, for me, it was, it drew heavily on an understanding of how type works. And after the accident, I was derpy for quite a while, and things that were effortless to me before were just out of reach. You know, they were closed off, and it was just something I'll never forget. Some of the simplest things that on the computer or within programs or pick one, you know, that I could no longer do. You know, I just couldn't. It's not that I couldn't remember how to do it, but I couldn't do it. It's as if I'd never done it before. Interestingly, as a side note, did you know driving with a concussion is illegal in Michigan? Yeah, I found that out. Weird, huh? Anyway, so at any rate, time went on and I got back to work, resumed the kiosk project. The project turned out great. I mean, they sent the forms off to, I believe, it was either Douglas Steel. I think it was Auro. They have a laser that cuts half-inch thick aluminum. It cuts aluminum. I still can't get my head around a laser powerful enough. I know, we're living in the future. But the words, it all came through beautifully. We decided to use 4 polycarbonate inserts. This is kind of a frosted, thin plastic you see in backlit signage and so on, and it's bulletproof. This stuff lasts forever. We applied both blue and green film to the polycarbonate, so certain words would appear in certain colors. LEDs were designed and installed within the kiosk, and there was a cap situated on top. It was all custom. You know, the footings and the pedestal were put in. The kiosk was installed and leveled, and the whole thing was approved, you know, through our architecture firm to be sure that, you know, that it would work, because all these one-offs, you had to do that. One of my fears was, and it was totally, totally kind of misguided, but based on my own misspent youth, was, you know, what if somebody wants to climb this thing? You know, kids, I remember this really dumb things that I used to do as a kid, being bored, and, you know, I pictured somebody climbing this thing and getting a finger caught, and, you know, just all these bad outcomes. But that hasn't happened, nor I don't think it will happen. At night, you know, it lights up, and it's remarkably unique, especially when the pavement's wet, because you get these strong reflections of the color in the pavement, you know. One of those things that you just don't factor in, you didn't imagine until it's real. Huh? We have a video. There's a video of a student, an international student, coming in, and he's standing in front of this thing, and he turns with this giant smile on his face, and they're interviewing him. And he's, yeah, that's my language, you know, it's hello in my language. And it was so cool, you know, seeing his face light up like that and having something he could identify with, you know, so personally here on the campus of Lansing Community College. It's on our downtown campus. Come see it. As far as the head injury goes, I only brought that up really to point out a few things. Last year, there were over 56,000 fatalities caused from head trauma. That is not a made-up number, 56,000. I did some, you know, some looking around, and I was interested in this, and it's staggering. There was an online forum, I think it was Reddit, where a question was posed to all the medical professionals out there. And the question was, medical professionals of Reddit, if you could impart one piece of advice, one tip to increase the quality of someone's life, what would it be? And of course, you know, there's this this flood of comments, but the top comment, the very top comment overwhelmingly was, hang on to the handrail. When you're going up the stairs and down the stairs, just use the handrail. Just can you do that? And it had to do with these accidents that, you know, people are get their arms loaded up and they're going on up and down the stairs and, you know, hit your head and it could be game over, you know. So it's kind of a thing. So regarding the fainting, I did get an appointment with a neurospecialist out at MSU, and they got me in. He must have had an opening, you know, really, really smart guy. And he had all these strange questions, not just about the injury, but about the time preceding the injury and so on. And what he arrived at, the cause of this accident that sidelined me for so long, was skinny pants. Yeah, skinny pants. That was the motivating cause. It blew my mind. You know, how he deducted this, but, you know, going up the stairs, these big flights of stairs, I'm wearing these, you know, these pants, you know, the slacks that are, you know, skinny pants, thin. Got up the stairs, got the blood going, crouched down to unlock the door, and the pants cut off my blood flow behind my knees. You know, it halted it, you know, momentarily. Getting the key in there and getting the lock. Then when I stood up, you know, it released it. And that rush of blood caused me to faint. And that was it. That was skinny pants. So I guess if there's any takeaway, it's to be mindful of wardrobe choices as they apply to daily functionality. Bob Marley once said, "Enjoy life now. This is not a rehearsal." If you want to check out what I've been talking about, just visit this episode at lccconnect.org. Art Happens Here is a production of LCC Connect. Thanks for lending us your imagination.
This is WLNZ Lansing. You're listening to LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. To find out more about LCC Connect programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.